Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Dr. Max Baker-Hite, who's a tutorial fellow in philosophy at Oxford University. And he's published numerous academic papers and has recently released a book with Cambridge University Press called God and the Problem of Evidential Ambiguity. Max, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ruth. It's a real honour to be on the show.
Oh, well, you're obviously no stranger at all to Unbelievable. You've spoken on lots of deep philosophical issues. But today we're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis, which is very exciting. So I guess it makes sense to go right back to the beginning. How did you first come across C.S. Lewis? We'll dive into his philosophy later, but just take us back to the beginning.
No, absolutely. Well, I suppose, like probably a lot of people in the UK, I heard about C.S. Lewis firstly through his Narnia stories. So I think when I was a child, I got taken to see a play, a dramatic production of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. I actually didn't read the rest of the Narnia Chronicles, though, at that point. So I kind of was aware of Lewis as an author and a fantasy author in particular. But it wasn't really until I was a teenager, and so I should say I haven't always been a Christian. As a teenager, I was an agnostic, and when I went to university to study philosophy as an undergraduate at the age of 19, through various circumstances, I started to investigate Christianity, and it was at that point that I became aware of Lewis as kind of an intellectual figure. And in particular, I read Mere Christianity. And that's where I sort of, in a way, I think for the first time encountered the idea of an intellectual case for Christianity.
So would you say then that Lewis has had a significant impact on your faith journey in that process?
Oh, absolutely. I think I've had sort of seasons where I've really been impacted by Lewis's writing. And then when I became a Christian, and that was around 2005. But then around 2012, for various reasons, I started getting into some of Lewis's theological fiction in a way that I hadn't. So not Narnia, but things like The Great Divorce, The Screwtape Letters, and the Ransom Trilogy, or sometimes people call it the Space Trilogy, which I think a lot, some people have never heard of that one, and I absolutely loved that. Yeah. And I think that gave me an even deeper appreciation for the genius of Lewis, in particular the way that he was able to articulate philosophical ideas through fiction in a way that I think was even more powerful than through ordinary prose.
Brilliant. And this might be like asking you to pick your favourite child, Max, but if you could whittle it down to your favourite Lewis quote or book or collection of works, is there anything that really stands out to you, or does it depend on how you're feeling and where you're at?
Yeah, well, no, I probably could do if you really force me to.
I'm forcing you to.
Yeah, that's fine. So I think the Signature Classics is a collection of like seven of Lewis's theological works, which includes like Mere Christianity, Problem of Pain, Miracles, Grief Observed, The Great Divorce, The Screwtape Letters, and The Abolition of Man. I think that sort of somewhere in there are my top Lewis favourites. I mean, I think my top two favourites, and I probably can't choose between them, would be the Great Divorce and The Screwtape Letters.
Okay, that's brilliant. I mean, they're strong choices, aren't they? I think I'm not gonna force you to whittle it down to one. I'm sure we'll unpack this more as we talk about Lewis as philosopher, but do you feel like reading Lewis has changed your mind on any particular issues?
Oh, that's interesting. I think one of the most profound insights I think Lewis has is concerning the nature of sort of moral development through our lives. And so something that really has bothered me at certain points in my Christian journey is the kind of question of why do some people who, you know, profess to be Christians seem to be such rubbish people, to put it bluntly. But Lewis, I mean, I think Lewis was an absolutely brilliant student of human nature. And one of the insights that he has that I've been most profoundly affected by is something that comes through, especially in the two works that I mentioned, The Great Divorce and The Screwtape Letters. And it's to do with the way that, as Lewis sees it, human moral choice, what it's really kind of, what it comes down to is how do I respond to, what do I do with the raw materials that my circumstances, my upbringing, all of that kind of thing have given me. It's not necessarily kind of going to be judged very well on the basis of how it looks on the outside. So you could have two people, and one has had a really difficult upbringing, a violent, abusive home. Perhaps they're even kind of genetically predisposed towards anger. And another person with a very peaceful, loving kind of home and upbringing. And the first person may sort of react in anger and swear or something if he's cut up in traffic. But what he was really inclined to do was get out of the car and physically beat up the person who cut him up. Whereas the second person still swore at the person who cut them up in traffic. And I think the way Lewis would look at that was that the first person actually may have grown a lot more in their moral character, even though outwardly the two outcomes are the same. And so I found that really helpful because I think, you know, it's so easy to judge other people, isn't it, when we read about people in the news who've done terrible things. And I'm not by any means saying that we shouldn't want a justice system that, appropriately hands down penalties for crimes and so on. But I think in terms of when we're tempted to place ourselves in judgment over other people, I think just checking ourselves and realizing we have no idea for the most part what are the raw materials that person had to work with in their life.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you, Max. Given that you are a stalwart philosopher, let's talk about Lewis as a philosopher, because it's certainly something we've not talked about loads on this show, and I don't know that it gets talked about that much elsewhere. But I mean, again, going back to the beginning, do we know what sort of philosophical education Lewis had at all?
We do have some idea. So the first point at which Lewis probably came into contact with serious philosophy was when he was taught by William Kirkpatrick, his tutor, who he called the Great Knock, it's pretty clear from some of the things Lewis says about the kinds of questions that William Kirkpatrick would ask him, that he was at least getting him to think in a philosophical, a sort of critical thinking mindset. But then we know that he studied greats at Oxford, and that has a philosophy part to it. And we also know that before he got his permanent position at Magdalen, he did a stint at University College Oxford, where he taught philosophy tutorials. So there's no doubt that he was exposed to a lot of philosophy. And I think that's quite obvious in some of his works.
Yeah, and I think there's a quote, I think it's in Miracles, where he says, "Those who, like myself, have had a philosophical rather than a scientific education." So he obviously sees himself as having a good underpinning of philosophy. I mean, do we know, again, who some of the key philosophers that he might have been reading, what were some of the philosophical theories that impacted his work and sort of undergirded a lot of what he was writing about?
Yeah, I mean, we can make inferences more than we have explicit citations from him of other philosophers. So it's very clear that he was very influenced by Plato. So the idea that there's this sort of realm of perfect forms, and that the ultimate forms being goodness, truth, and beauty, and that the sensible world, the world that we perceive that's in flux, is in some sense a shadow of that realm of forms. And actually you get that played out almost fairly explicitly at the end of the last battle, where Aslan's country has the real versions of England and of Narnia. And the versions they'd been experiencing before were in some sense just a shadow of the greater reality. I think it's clear he was very influenced by Augustine. So Lewis's understanding of sin, the human condition, in terms of not sort of a lack of love, as it were, but actually of loving things in the wrong order, loving certain things more than other things, and that leading to a distortion. I think he may have been influenced by Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas. So one of Aquinas's big ideas was that the sort of moral landscape of human life is something that flows from our natures. And in particular, you know, what is it for human beings to flourish? And the moral landscape very much flows out of facts about what human flourishing consists in. So in terms of people that Lewis was clearly aware of that, but didn't kind of agree with, David Hume, we know that he engaged with some of Hume's ideas, specifically about miracles. Mm. And also Nietzsche, I think, is implicitly in view in The Abolition of Man, this figure who wants to sort of start over and construct values and basically to do so as an expression of human power. And that's, I think, very clearly representing Nietzsche's ideas.
Yeah. Max, do we know if Lewis saw himself as a philosopher? I mean, other than his stint at UNIV, he wasn't a philosophy professor or anything, but did he see himself as a philosopher? Was that part of how we should see him as well?
That's a really interesting question. So I've got some quotes here where he explicitly says he's not. So in Miracles, he says, "I'm not a professional philosopher or a theologian, but an amateur ready to learn from others." In his essay on Christian apologetics, he says, I was not born to be a philosopher. I have no talent for clarifying or simplifying." Now, to me, that just says that Lewis was a very humble man and he was very self-effacing. And I think many of us would beg to differ with him about that, because I think that's one of Lewis's greatest gifts, is for clarifying and simplifying things. And so I think the way I would put it would be that Lewis wasn't a philosopher in a strict sense of the word, but he certainly had good philosophical instincts.
I think that's a really helpful clarification. And it's always worth respecting what someone says about themselves, isn't it? Even if it is just, you know, a humble comment. How did Lewis's thinking compare with some of his contemporaries, the other sort of 20th century philosophers? Was what he's saying in line with what some of them were saying? Was it dramatically different? Obviously, you mentioned Hume, but were there any other philosophers that he was kind of engaging with with similarities and differences?
Yeah. So, I mean, for one thing, and I know we'll come on to talk about this a bit later, but Lewis's argument from reason, famously, he actually got to test that out in debate with Elizabeth Anscombe. Mm. So he was certainly aware of her work. But yeah, more broadly, I think it's worth sort of saying that the school of thought, or the philosophical tradition that predominates in the Anglosphere, Britain and America in philosophy departments, really from the early 20th century up until now, is what's known as analytic philosophy, with this very heavy emphasis on kind of using formal logic, trying to define terms very precisely. Critics of this would say it's sort of pedantic and obsessed with the minutiae, laying out your arguments, if possible, as premise one, premise two. And that sort of thing might sound familiar to listeners, but so that broadly speaking would be how kind of analytic philosophy does things, and that's definitely the tradition I work in, and I suppose it's insofar as that was very much the type of philosophy being done in Oxford in the middle of the 20th century. Albeit different ideas were popular then than now, but a similar kind of sort of set of sensibilities about how to do philosophy. So I think it's inevitable that that's the kind of philosophy Lewis would have been most familiar with. But yeah, so I think Lewis definitely sort of, insofar as he shows an affinity for philosophical methods, it seems to be more those types of methods that I've just described, more than if you were to say pick up Nietzsche's work, you would find it reads almost more like poetry. It's not that kind of logic chopping type thing. And Lewis certainly was capable of, as we know, of writing very poetically and very imaginatively. But I think especially in a text like Miracles, which I would possibly see as his most philosophical work, I think he's writing more like an analytic philosopher.
Mm. That's a really helpful clarification, Max. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Bird, co-host of the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, and I want to ask you, what exactly is the gospel? You'd think Christians would generally agree on this, but actually, there are some rich and important differences in how the gospel can be understood. That's why I edited with Jason Maston a new book called 5 Views on the Gospel, part of the Counterpoint series from Zondervan Academic. We've gathered together 5 absolutely brilliant scholars: Michael Horton, Scott McKnight, David De Silva, Julie Marr, and Shively Smith, each offering a different take on what the gospel really is. Justification by faith, declaring Jesus is king, spiritual transformation, liberation from oppression. I mean, each view is, in a sense, rooted in scripture and history and contemporary mission, but they don't always agree. This book explores, what are we saved from? What are we saved for? And what does it mean to live a life worthy of the gospel? Whether you're a preacher, a student, or just curious, 5 Views on the Gospel will challenge and deepen your understanding of the good news of Jesus Christ. Available now wherever good theology books are sold.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. I mean, he obviously, as you say, has written lots of fiction and poetic work, and he's well known probably particularly for his fiction and apologetics work, but he's not always necessarily given significant attention within academic circles. Why do you think that is? And do you think that reflects on the quality or relevance of his thought? Or is that, yeah, why is that?
That's really interesting. So I was talking to someone who's a fellow in English at Magdalen recently, and he was reflecting that actually Lewis is seen quite sympathetically now by most of his colleagues in a way that maybe he wouldn't have been 20 or 30 years ago. So I think probably these things kind of come in waves, don't they? But I certainly think there's no doubt that Lewis has had an impact in academia. It's just not always in the areas you would necessarily expect him to. So, I mean, at the time, Lewis, what did attract the ire of some of his colleagues in the English faculty, because they felt it was improper to be doing this kind of popular level work as he was. And so, I think academics to this day have to navigate that tension, that the more they try to speak to a broader audience, the more they're going to rile up some of their colleagues who think that if you speak to a broader audience, you're going to be oversimplifying and you're going to miss the nuance. And so I think those sorts of things would explain why he might not get as much attention as you would perhaps think he might do. But nonetheless, as I'm sure we'll discuss more, I do think he has had an impact within some fields of scholarship.
Yeah. So are there contemporary philosophers that would draw on his work then, you'd say?
Yeah, there are. And it's actually not always the things you might expect. So, like, of course, you know, he's written on the problem of pain. He's written on, you know, various philosophical arguments for God. But for example, I'm currently revising an article for an academic journal on whether it's possible to perceive the absences of things. And I came across a piece that was on the experience of grief. And lo and behold, it quite extensively engaged with Lewis as a grief observed. And as far as I know, this philosopher wasn't a Christian at all. And it wasn't really a sort of philosophy of religion type discussion. And so, yeah, Lewis's influence still sort of is very much there, as I said, even in places you might not expect. But certainly that there definitely have been discussions in philosophy of religion where Lewis's work is often referred to. I would say particularly arguments about the relationship between God and morality. Lewis, you know, wasn't the first, but certainly was an important thinker articulating a relationship between objective ethics and God, and trying to formulate an argument for God from objective ethics. But actually also Lewis's The Abolition of Man is a text that gets discussed in philosophical sort of discussions around transhumanism and whether it's right to try to use technology to alter human nature. I've seen, yeah, as The Abolition of Man is certainly treated as a text to be taken seriously there.
Well, and we're going to dive into some of those specific philosophical arguments in some future episodes. But he obviously talks about philosophy in, as you say, the more sort of philosophical works like Miracles. Does he weave any of his philosophy into his more apologetic or fiction works at all, Max?
I think undoubtedly. And I would almost say when you start really thinking about how he's done this, it's almost tempting to say that the fiction is, for Lewis, a vehicle of exploring philosophical ideas. So I'll just pull out two examples because I've just finished reading through the Narnia Chronicles with my 9-year-old daughter, which has been a lot of fun. So, yeah, a couple of examples that spring to mind there. So I'm actually just going to quote this passage from The Silver Chair. So this brilliant moment where the protagonists, Eustace and Jill and Puddleglum, have found Prince Rillian, who's really supposed to be the rightful heir to the throne of Narnia. But, you know, he's been held captive by this witch in this underworld for years. And now he realizes his true identity, and the witch is trying to stop them escaping. And she puts this sort of powder in the fire that's kind of, you know, like a hallucinogenic or something. And she tries to convince them there's no such thing as the overworld. And it's a really fascinating bit. And she says, there is no sun. And Puddle Glum says, yes, there is, though. We've seen it. We've walked under it. We've talked to people who live there. And it's very different from this. The witch shook her head. There is no overworld, no sun, no sky. No, you've dreamed of such things. Oh, but I must have seen the sun, insisted Jill. In my world, I've seen it thousands of times. It's like a huge lamp hanging in the sky. You see, said the witch, as if she were triumphing, you're only making up words and pictures about things that aren't there. This lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a children's story. Anyway, so I love that passage because the witch is, I mean, there's lots of things Lewis could be doing through that. But I think one of the things he may well be doing is sort of gently having a dig at Freudian theories about projection, the idea that God is just a psychological projection based on. So we have earthly parents and those are real enough. But we just kind of we take those and sort of imaginatively inflate them on and project them onto the heavens. And it's and God is a sort of just the product of a wish fulfillment. And I think, Lewis was having a little bit of fun and kind of having a go at that theory in that passage. Another one, which I think is one of the less appreciated Narnia books, The Horse and His Boy. So, you know, Shasta, who's kind of the main protagonist, really, he goes on this long adventure that involves him eventually having to try to save Narnia from invasion by this Calamine prince. But anyway, along the way, there are various episodes where he's chased or by a lion, or there's one point where he's having to sleep alone in this kind of this area with tombs at night, and this cat comes to comfort him. And Aslan reveals himself to Shasta at the end, and he says, I was the lion who forced you to join with Aravis. Aravis is this girl who becomes his companion. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals away from you while you slept. So I think Lewis has a really interesting exploration of ideas about divine providence and the idea of how the way in which God can sort of weave circumstances together and such that we don't at the time necessarily connect all the dots, but that in hindsight we're able to see how God was at work in all sorts of subtle ways. I think more generally there's loads of ways in which Lewis explores this thought that evil is not an equal and opposite reality to good. Evil is a sort of shadowy, insubstantial reality, if you could even call it a reality at all. It's kind of parasitic upon goodness. And one of the very vivid ways Lewis depicts this is in The Great Divorce, that it transpires that hell, which is this kind of grey, very sort of gloomy city that some of the inhabitants leave for a day trip to heaven. It turns out that hell is so tiny, it sort of is even smaller than a drop of dew on a blade of grass in heaven. So yeah, I mean, there's so many more examples that could be given.
And do you think that fiction is an effective means through which to explore these philosophical concepts? Is it good because in some ways it sort of subtly infiltrates rather than the, I guess something like Miracles is probably quite tricky to read if you have absolutely no philosophical grounding whatsoever.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Lewis saw that the way to really communicate sometimes quite difficult ideas to a really wide audience was through narrative. And I think he would have agreed that people can intuitively grasp things often better than they can put into words. And I think that by communicating these ideas through narrative and through fiction, that he is imparting ideas to people who mostly won't have a philosophical training, but will be able to kind of intuitively get what he's trying to say.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that he's obviously famous for is writing as a Christian. To what extent do his personal religious beliefs shape some of his philosophical arguments? Is it in any way possible to separate the thinker from his faith when we're evaluating his philosophy? And I mean, do we even need to do that?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, so I think Lewis undoubtedly has this really deep conviction that pursuing the arguments fearlessly will ultimately lead someone to God. And so I think he would want his argument, especially his more explicitly philosophical arguments, such as those in Miracles, perhaps some of the passages in Mere Christianity, I think he would want those to be evaluated by a person who isn't yet sure what they think about the existence of God, and would want them to be read in a way that doesn't sort of presuppose the existence of God, but rather tries to make the case for accepting theism. So, yeah, I think on the one hand, he has a deep confidence, I think, that though that's seriously and conscientiously looking at the evidence and the arguments will ultimately lead someone there towards theism and indeed Christianity. But I also think he does want to try and operate on a kind of a common ground, as it were, with skeptics.
Yeah, that's really helpful, which again is his wide appeal, isn't it, in terms of speaking to so many different types of people. I mean, what can those of us who are trying to engage with some of the big philosophical questions today, what can we learn from Lewis through some of his more philosophical ideas?
So I think one of the things Lewis was very good at in his non-fiction writings, where he's more explicitly scrutinizing arguments, is showing what certain positions and certain ways of thinking that are very commonplace actually implicitly commit you to. And he does that at the start of Mere Christianity, where he tries to convince the reader that whatever you may say about morality, you do in fact act and think as though there is objective morality, as though there is a moral law. And so, yeah, I think that's certainly something that we can all kind of be aware of when we start to think about these questions, is that we might think we're blank slates, as it were, when we approach these questions, but we will all have implicit ways of thinking and acting that commit us to certain positions that we actually may not like when we realize that.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.